Claire Balderson, welcome to Congress and the Commander-in-Chief here on the BBC World Service. On the eve of a crucial vote on military action against Syria, I'm trying to find out who has the power to order American forces into battle.
I will seek authorization for the use of force from the American people's representatives in Congress. Yet while I believe I have the authority to carry out this military action without specific congressional authorization, I know that the country will be stronger if we take this course and our actions will be even more effective.
President Obama sounding every bit the commander-in-chief that he is when he made that surprise announcement. He was going against a long tradition of administrations, including his own, acting without backing from the elected lawmakers in both chambers of Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate. But as he said, he didn't think he needed their approval, and it's not clear whether he's going to be bound by what they decide in the next few days. In fact, even members and former members of Congress themselves can't agree on whether their word holds sway over his.
The Constitution of the United States, Article 1, Section 8, makes it abundantly clear that no president has the right to go to war absent approval of Congress.
I think that the president did not have any need to go to Congress for authority to take the kind of action he's contemplating against Syria for the use of chemical weapons.
The president is not the arbiter of whether or not we go to war. It is Congress that decides whether or not America actually puts boots on the ground. This is not the president's call at all. In a democracy, you have to respect that.
In this program, I'm trying to understand the relationship between president and Congress when it comes to one of the most significant decisions a country ever takes, launching military action against a foreign power. The Constitution seems to me a good place to start.
The Congress shall have power to declare war and to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years.
That's from Article 1 of the Constitution, the 224-year-old document that forms the bedrock of all law in the United States. At its heart is the idea of the separation of powers. Congress, cited in that article, is the legislative branch. Then there's the executive in the form of the presidency, and then there's the judiciary. So what does the Constitution have to say about the president and war?
The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States.
If you go back and read the debates at the Constitutional Convention, they're pretty one-sided.
Joe Lieberman was a senator, first for the Democratic Party, then an independent, for more than two decades until his retirement at the beginning of this year.
It's quite clear that the people who drafted the Constitution had bad memories of kings taking countries into war for their own purposes, and the people of the realm suffered. Nonetheless, they drafted a Constitution that in Article 1 gave Congress the power to declare war, and Article 2 gave the president the powers of commander-in-chief and set up the tension that has existed since then. I always think that the framers of the Constitution probably had in mind that there would be military actions short of what was understood to be war that a president could take without getting an actual declaration of war by Congress, and that's the way it's been since then.
In fact, the ink was barely dry on the Constitution when, in 1801, President Thomas Jefferson sent a naval force to defend U.S. shipping interests against Barbary pirates off the coast of North Africa. He didn't ask Congress first. They didn't declare war, though he did get their backing through a series of resolutions and laws after the event.
Someone makes a move of which we don't approve. Who is it that always intervenes? UN and OAS, they have their place, I guess. But first, send the Marines.
The American Congress has only formally declared war five times in its history. The last time was during the Second World War. But US presidents have sent missiles and troops and warships into conflict dozens of times since then. How come? Julian Zelizer is professor of history at Princeton University.
We've seen a significant increase in presidential power over the course of the 20th century through current times and more willingness for presidents to send U.S. forces or use U.S. air power in military operations without really consulting Congress or without giving Congress much of a role in the decision making.
Last weekend, I was awakened in the early morning hours and told that six members of the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States had sent an urgent request that we join them in a military operation to restore order and democracy to Grenada.
My fellow citizens, last night I ordered U.S. military forces to Panama. No president takes such action lightly. This morning, I want to tell you what I did and why I did it.
My fellow Americans, today our armed forces joined our NATO allies in airstrikes against Serbian forces responsible for the brutality in Kosovo. We have acted with resolve for several reasons.
Today, I authorize the armed forces of the United States to begin a limited military action in Libya in support of an international effort to protect Libyan civilians. That action has now begun.
Presidents Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, and Obama, in the now familiar formal address to the nation, usually from the Oval Office, each announcing military operations underway without any prior approval from Congress.
The president really is supposed to ask for a declaration of war from Congress, and this is what happened during World War I and during World War II. But since 1950, the president is often willing to use the force, making the decision without any kind of big formal debate. There's enough leeway in the Constitution that they can do that, most agree. And they've used that power, both Democrats and Republicans, quite frequently ever since the Korean War.
What changed in the Korean War?
In the United States, the executive branch was just getting more powerful, both in domestic and foreign policy. There were more people working around the president. There were more national security advisors. The State Department was getting bigger. The Pentagon was getting bigger. They just had more muscle, the president, to make these kinds of decisions on their own. And I think that was an important change. I think also some of the success of World War II emboldened presidents to use force when necessary. And presidents started to feel that Congress was a slow institution, it was an inefficient institution, and that when you had to make decisions in an age of nuclear war about the risks that the world faced and the risks that the country faced, there wasn't enough time to have a long, drawn-out debate with an institution that's notoriously slow.
Slow for several reasons. The 100 members of the Senate pride themselves on their deliberative process. First, there's a discussion by a committee. Then legislation goes to the full Senate for what can be lengthy debate. Meanwhile, on the other side of the Capitol building, 435 members of the House of Representatives are discussing the same issue, but not always with the same wording. So, once passed in both chambers, different versions of laws have to be reconciled, and then everyone votes again. Sometimes, though, events prompt a more definitive response. The widespread anger over the Vietnam War, the sense amongst the American public and politicians alike that they'd been led into it, unwilling and unconsulted, stirred Congress into action. In 1973, it passed the War Powers Resolution, an attempt to keep a check on the president's war-making abilities. Former Senator Joe Lieberman told me what it says.
The War Powers Resolution actually sets out, in the aftermath of the Vietnam and Korean wars, in which Presidents Truman, Kennedy, Johnson took America into what certainly looked like a war in terms of troops on the ground, etc., without congressional authority. And the War Powers Resolution, which is the law of the land, says that a president can go to war in only three cases. One, with a declaration of war. Secondly, with an authorization for the use of military force, which is what's happened mostly since then. And then third, in the case of emergency attack against the United States or our armed forces, to take unilateral action for a limited period of time. So it seems to me that a president would not want to have American troops on the ground or be involved in an extended air campaign against a foreign country without at least getting an authorization for the use of military force.
Which is exactly why George W. Bush asked Congress for authorization before the invasion of Iraq. That was unusual. As Senator Lieberman says, the War Powers Resolution is the law of the land. But in 1973, there was a fight to get it through. President Nixon vetoed the legislation. It took two-thirds majorities in both chambers of Congress to override the veto. But still, no president since then has ever acknowledged the legitimacy of the War Powers Resolution. Plenty have ignored it altogether.
Earlier this evening, from the centre of the city, we could see the flash of explosions on the horizon, as well as the tracer of anti-aircraft fire. At one point, a large orange fireball drifted across the night sky before floating down to earth.
President Clinton didn't ask Congress for approval before or after joining the military campaign against Serbian forces in Kosovo. That was in 1999 when NATO conducted an air war and then sent in ground forces, including American troops. Tom Campbell was a Republican in the House of Representatives at the time, and he was furious. The problem, as he saw it, was that President Clinton had ignored even the parts of the War Powers Resolution intended to give the Commander-in-Chief a bit of leeway.
The compromise was there are occasions when the president might have to use force, but within 60 days after initiating such activity, he has to get approval of Congress or else withdraw the troops. Well, in this case, President Clinton had been bombing Belgrade, Yugoslavia, for more than 30 days without any constitutional compliance, and he continued the bombing for 78 days.
So Congressman Campbell took the president to court. He tried to sue him for using American forces unlawfully under the Constitution and under the War Powers Resolution. The case didn't go anywhere. The court ruled it wasn't justified. It couldn't hear it. But wouldn't it have been better to deal with the issue in Congress itself?
When I proposed to go to court, before that, I proposed to put the vote onto the floor of the House of Representatives so that when I went into court, I could say that I attempted all I could within the legislative process. The War Powers Resolution is unique in all American law by allowing a single member of the House of Representatives or the Senate to bring a vote to the floor. So I used that power.
Except that nobody wanted to hear it. Perhaps understandably, the Democratic Party leader in the House of Representatives was trying to protect his president. The Republican, Mr. Campbell, accepted that.
More shocking was the response from the Speaker of the House of my own party, whose representatives said, "Look, if this goes badly, we do not want our fingerprints on it. Let this be President Clinton's war. If it goes badly, we will wish we hadn't voted on it." And subsequent events have proven that to be true. You might remember the primary campaign between then-Senator Hillary Clinton and then-Senator Barack Obama. What was the strongest argument Senator Barack Obama had against Senator Hillary Clinton? That she had voted in favor of going to war in Iraq. So you can see how the political interest of leaders in Congress is not to go on the record, though the Constitution requires that they do.
So it's not just that the presidency has been getting stronger. Congress, it seems to me, has been the architect of its own fate. It would rather not have to make these incredibly hard decisions, literally matters of life or death. Denis Kucinich agrees. For 16 years, he was a Democratic member of the House of Representatives, where he was a passionate opponent of the Iraq War. He was also a vocal critic of President Obama's failure to get congressional approval for the attacks on Libya that led to the fall of the Gaddafi regime.
Congress has been weak. Congress has been willing to let presidents make the decision. Congress does have a responsibility here. You know, there's a theory in law that if you don't act on your rights, you lose them. However, when it comes to the right of Congress to declare a war, that's a constitutional right. If you don't act on it, you don't lose it. It still exists.
It's beginning to sound as if Congress is little more than a rubber stamp to be used as cover when a president thinks he needs it, to be dismissed when he intends to go ahead with a military venture anyway. Senator Joe Lieberman says it's not quite like that. In his experience, when a president asks for authority to use military force, Congress gives it real thought and deliberation.
When Saddam Hussein in 1990 invaded Kuwait, President Bush began to amass American forces in the Middle East, ultimately over 500,000. And there was first a debate about whether the president could actually go to war to get Saddam out of Kuwait without congressional authorization. But then we got into really quite a battle about whether we should give authorization. And we had a very tough debate, which turned out to be more partisan than I hoped it would be. The vote was only 52 to 47 in the Senate. You know, three senators could have turned it the other way, and you would have had 500,000 American soldiers over in the Middle East waiting to be given the order to go to war to get Saddam out of Kuwait with basically nothing to do but pick up their stuff and come home. It was very tense, a very important moment. And, of course, the resolution passed very closely. The war commenced, and it was over in 100 hours. And then, of course, victory has 1,000 parents. Everybody was supportive of what had happened. But that was a close call.
Senator Lieberman was in favor of granting authorization then, and more than a decade later, he also backed the younger President Bush when he appealed to Congress for support in invading Iraq. But the former senator says it would be wrong to think that the only role Congress has is agreeing or not agreeing with a president who's already made up his mind.
Congress has the power of its voice as the representative of the people to influence what a president does, whether he commits American troops, and whether he decides to come to Congress for authorization. The ultimate power that Congress has is the power of the purse, because Congress has the authority. It's not easy to exercise while your troops are in combat, but Congress has the power to cut off funding, and came pretty close to doing that at one or two times during the Iraq War.
At the moment, the Democratic Party is in the majority in the Senate, the Republicans in the House of Representatives. The parties are bitterly divided, and there are divisions within each one as well. That's what's making this vote on using force against Syria so difficult to predict. Molly Ball is national political reporter for The Atlantic magazine, and she doesn't see members in either chamber voting on party lines.
I actually see less political point scoring on this than you generally see in the United States Congress, which everybody loves to hate. It's been called a conscience vote for both parties in the House of Representatives, and that means a vote on which the leaders, Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner, don't engage in arm twisting and horse trading behind the scenes. They leave it to the individual politicians to decide how their principles and their constituents lead them to vote. That's a big thing for the White House to have to overcome when it sits down with these members of Congress. And so far, the case that the White House is making is not winning over a whole lot of people.
A president and his staff working the phones, party leaders trying to get their members on side while allowing them to vote according to their consciences, members of the public emailing and calling to tell their representatives what they think they should do, and a president who hasn't made it clear whether or not he'll abide by Congress's decision when it's made. Is this a good way to make momentous foreign policy decisions? Professor Julian Zelizer again.
Champions of the presidency like the idea that we centralize all of these decisions in one body, so to speak, and that we can act with efficiency and speed. And the image of the commander-in-chief as a superhero almost has some appeal. But the design of the U.S. government has a logic, and the separation of power and the need to make every decision through this duel between the president and Congress has an important function. You also want the president to have some fear of Congress. That can be healthy. That's the separation of power, the checks and balances. You want the president to fear that Congress can say no. Again, it doesn't always work well, and we haven't figured it out exactly, but I think there's a great value to the system that we have.
I love that you say we haven't figured it out, because the framers of the Constitution thought that they had it figured out. They wrote it down. This is how it should work. And yet, the way you're describing it, it really seems as if, as you say, every single time there's an instance, there's a need for action, you have to work it out.
Well, three things they didn't anticipate. First was the growth of presidential power. The presidency just has much more institutional power than the founders ever imagined. Second, the nature of war has changed so dramatically, first with nuclear war and now with drone airplanes and the kind of strikes that can take place around the globe within minutes. And I don't think the founders fully anticipated the kind of gridlock that Congress could get itself in and just how slow that institution could be.
It's nearly 3 weeks since the chemical weapons attack in Damascus that led President Obama to contemplate punishment attacks on the Syrian government. It could be another week before Congress delivers its verdict. So was asking the lawmakers the wrong thing for Mr. Obama to do? Richard Haass is a former senior U.S. diplomat, now president of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Congress is a fact of life. In the case of foreign policy, the Constitution and more than two centuries of American political history make it clear that the initiative largely rests with the executive. But that said, you know, an executive is foolhardy if it doesn't consult with Congress, if it doesn't take congressional views into account. But where this administration erred, I would argue, is by doing more than taking congressional views into account, but essentially saying we, the United States, are not going to act unless we are granted authority to act by the Congress. And that, to me, is a real departure from what really is post-World War II American politics.
And Richard Haass worries that Barack Obama is setting a dangerous precedent for the handling of foreign policy.
It establishes a procedural requirement that you simply may not want to live with. So much of foreign policy needs to be made as events unfold, and you do need to be able to project a degree of certainty and reliability, particularly when it comes to smaller actions and responses to developments. And there, I think it's unwise in the formal sense to bring parliaments or congresses into the action. Obviously, you need to bring them in, potentially even in a formal sense, when it comes to enormous commitments, either in scale or in duration. But that's not the sort of thing we're talking about here, and it's not the sort of thing that normally arises.
Maybe, though, this attempt to collaborate with Congress in the way it seems the framers of the Constitution intended will have the opposite effect. As Molly Ball of The Atlantic says, why bother consulting lawmakers if you know they won't give you what you want?
If Congress hands him a defeat, you've got to think that future presidents will think twice about this idea of going to Congress in the first place, particularly if they don't think it's necessary. The White House says this is something that they didn't have to do legally, and if they get burned by having optionally gone to Congress and Congress saying no, you've got to think that a future president in that position would say, well, I'm within my rights to do this, and I'm just going to do this, because look what happened to President Obama.
There's no guarantee at all that the House and the Senate will authorize an attack on Syria by US forces. If that's the case and Mr. Obama does launch military action anyway, he would be entering uncharted territory. The commander-in-chief going against the explicit wishes of the United States Congress.
Stop calling it aggression. Ooh, we hate that expression. We only want the world to know that we support the status quo. They love us everywhere we go. So when in doubt, send the Marines.
Congress and the Commander-in-Chief was presented by me, Claire Balderson. The producers were Sandra Canthal and Mike Wendling. The